And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm glad to welcome Michael Cardos back to the program today. Michael was last on Book Talk to discuss his debut novel, The Three-Day Affair, which was named an Esquire Best Book of the Year. Mysterious Press has just published a second novel, and it's called Before He Finds Her. Michael, the novel starts off with an old newspaperman, Arthur Goodale, in the hospital, and he can't stop writing. What story is he obsessed with?
He's obsessed with a small-town murder. He has lived in this small town for decades, and he's obsessed with a murder that took place 15 years earlier, and now he's retired, but it's this case that he investigated when it happened and kept thinking about it and losing sleep over it, and now he runs a blog, but every once in a while he'll still post about it because it's unsolved.
And he's got a faithful 75 readers.
He's kind of amazed that he has 75 readers, as I think probably a lot of blog writers are. It's not a lot of people, but why would there be anybody? And yet there are some people who loyally read his posts.
Now, this murder took place in Silver Bay, New Jersey, and you yourself are from New Jersey. Was there a crime in your small town that you remember?
There actually was. I grew up in a town of about 7,000, which was sort of next to another small town, but there was really one murder when I was, I think it happened when I was in seventh or eighth grade, but, you know, the family went to, they were in our town and the kids went to our high school. It was just a really weird crime where a husband and wife were at the movie theater and they walked out of the movie theater and someone came up and repeatedly stabbed the wife. And then they realized later that the husband was in on it and it was with the girlfriend and who actually did it. And it was a very odd thing. And I'll tell you the one odd detail that has stuck with me for decades, which is that the husband set this up with the girlfriend, and he tied the knife to her hands so that it wouldn't slip. And that just seems just like the worst detail of all. Everybody knew about that murder for years and talked about it, and the family stayed in town, and you know, the father and the girlfriend ultimately went to prison for a long time. But it's just something that sort of became part of the fabric of the town, which like the fictional town I wrote about is otherwise a pretty peaceful, not necessarily idyllic, but still a sort of a quiet, peaceful town.
And it is a spousal murder, if I can pull out the 10-cent word, uxoricide.
Yeah.
In this book, it's Ramsey Miller kills his wife, Allie.
Mm-hmm. And he disappears. And so this becomes fodder for all sorts of town discussion over the years. Everyone in the town also assumes that he killed the daughter, who was younger than three at the time. This isn't really spoiling anything. It's given away by the second chapter, but it turns out that she was not murdered, but she was hidden away in the witness protection in West Virginia and basically grew up her whole life and pretty much in secrecy because everyone in her hometown assumes that she had been killed as well.
And that's something that Arthur does speculate. He goes, you know, a body was never found for, so do we know if she's alive or dead?
He basically says, he sort of repeats in his blog post the few things he knows for sure, and it's not many. I think there are three things, but pretty much he doesn't know what happened to the girl. And there had been some eyewitnesses of her father going on a little boat and going out to sea with what someone saw as a child-sized bundle, but no one knows for sure if it was the daughter or not.
And since it's still an unsolved case, it's still open, Arthur can't get to the police records of it.
Right, which is very frustrating, of course. It's technically an open case, so he can only speculate or, you know, interview the police, who will only tell him so much.
So we get to meet Melanie, as she's known now, 15 years later, and she's been secreted away in West Virginia, and those constraints are really starting to chafe her.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things for me in starting this novel was thinking about, you know, what would it be like to entirely grow up not only in a small rural town, which, you know, I live in a relatively small rural town now, and it's different from where I grew up in New Jersey. So part of it was just, you know, what would it be like to grow up in this very, very small community where you don't ever travel or see anywhere else, but sort of amp that up to the point where she rarely leaves the home, where she's never really allowed to have friends or associate with other people. And just even the backyard has high hedges. She's just really kind of kept there other than a couple of, you know, 4:30 p.m. dinners out with her aunt and uncle.
So she's homeschooled until 11th grade. Mm-hmm. She finally goes to the local high school for her senior year. And you're a college professor, and I'm sure you see a lot of homeschool kids pop up in the university system. Did you observe them to kind of get some of her behaviors?
I did talk to some homeschool students. We have a number of them, and a number of them are very good students. So what I had with Melanie was she was homeschooled until the 11th grade, and her aunt basically realized that she can't do it anymore. She's not a trained teacher exactly. So she let her go to the public high school for her 12th grade. And I talked to a number of homeschooled students just sort of about the logistics of how that works. And the one thing is that typically even students who are schooled at home do get together with other students for various projects, and so they can participate in things that sort of more traditionally schooled students would do. But Melanie isn't going to be allowed to do those kinds of things either.
Because they're afraid of her image or her name getting out into the media and her father being able to track her down and kill her.
That's right. And I think that's one thing about the difference maybe between a story like this taking place now versus one taking place before the internet is her aunt and uncle are very worried about any image of her or her name popping up or anything that people can sort of track her down. And as we all know, it's so much easier to find someone now than it was, say, 25 years ago.
And so she does resemble her mother a bit. Mm-hmm. And so just a different name and a face from a 3-year-old to an 18-year-old, it's not going to be that similar. But the fact that she has a resemblance to her mother does play into that.
Absolutely. And you know, and her aunt and uncle are also probably, you know, I'm thinking about realistically, they'd be overly protective, you know, and even if maybe it's a little much to think that someone would track her down from an image when she's 17, you know, why take that chance?
But it also makes her start to think about what is her life going to be like? She can't live with her aunt and her uncle for the rest of her life.
Yeah, and that's one thing that she thinks about is, you know, if I live till a ripe old age of 91, having never done anything, is that a success or is that a failure of all this?
She does have a secret boyfriend, and she does find ways to work in time around the margins of her schedule. His name's Philip. He's a Teach for America transplant down from up east to West Virginia. And he's not exactly a macho man.
No, he's not a macho man, which she realizes when he convinces her to go to carnival, like a town carnival at a church. While they're there, he kind of gets her to go on some rides and stuff, and she's all afraid of seeing people and people recognizing her and people seeing them as a couple. But it all seems to be going okay until they're walking along the street and a squirrel drops out of a tree. And this guy who has just said, "Don't worry, you know, Melanie, I'm going to protect you. You're going to be okay. You can be with me." A squirrel drops out of the tree and lands in front of them. And sort of in a sort of surprised moment, he retreats and leaves her alone. And you just hear, you know, flap, 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 flap of the sound of his flip-flops retreating. And Stephen, you don't know this, but that is really probably the one absolutely factual thing that I put into the novel. Katie and I were, my wife, our first trip that we ever took together was up to Niagara Falls. We were in grad school at Ohio State, and we'd been together about 6 months. We're like, let's take a trip, and we went up to Niagara Falls. And we're the night beforehand, we stayed in a town in New York that was real close to the falls, and there was a carnival there, and we went on some rides, and we're walking along the street, and that stupid squirrel landed on the ground, and I was wearing flip-flops, and all of a sudden, Katie turns around, and I wasn't there anymore. I was about 10 steps back. And then she knew she'd found the right guy.
Well, I don't know what's the bigger crime, being afraid of a squirrel or wearing flip-flops.
You know, I never discovered flip-flops until grad school. And then I sort of couldn't take them off my feet.
Now, I will say I've been frightened by a squirrel twice in my life. Once I did run because the damn thing seemed rabid.
See, this was my excuse. I was like, well, they could be rabid. But the thing but then Katie said, but... So you just left the rabbit squirrel to bite me. So the rabbit squirrel defense didn't really work.
Well, see, I did put my arm out, although my arm is a good 5 feet above where the squirrel is on the ground. But it was at the St. Louis Zoo. And I was there with a girl I was dating at the time. And it just like kept advancing on us and chattering very forcefully.
Well, it was almost certainly a rabbit squirrel. And I think you did the right thing by retreating.
And then I've had a squirrel attack me from a clothesline. It was sitting on the clothesline. I got too close, and it didn't really care for that.
Again, I'm sure it was rabid and very dangerous.
I think that one was just protecting its territory. Hey, I'm a little kind of guy. At one point, there's a stain on the rug in the house, and she had been sick when she had the flu when she was a kid. I was wondering, how would she get the flu if she doesn't get to see other kids?
Oh, boy. She can get it from anybody. Get it from her aunt and uncle. From the mailman.
We go to a flashback sequence. In both of your novels, you have extensive kind of dual timeline setups. And this one, we get to see her father in 1991 in the days leading up to the murder, plus also even further flashbacks to his youth. Why do you like the multiple timeline approach?
In the new novel, there's kind of two things going on. And one, as you said, is that there's two timelines going for the whole story. So you've got the one in 2006, which is the present day, and then you've got the 1991, which is the backstory. And they kind of more or less toggle back and forth. And I think part of that is I always have liked novels that do toggle between perspectives, but I thought that shifting them in time would be pretty interesting because it sort of privileges the reader's position, because the reader is the only one with access to all the information. Whereas, you know, Melanie in 2006 is not privy to her father's backstory. And the father in 1991 obviously is not privy to what's going to happen in 15 years. So I think it has to do with privileging the reader and kind of creating like this overall sense of dramatic irony where the reader kind of just has an understanding that none of the characters are quite able to get. And so you're able to read passages and interpret them a little differently than the characters themselves because you've read the other chapters.
Do you think in privileging the reader, you're kind of inviting them in, saying, hey, we got a secret together?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. You kind of create this collage that the reader is starting to see how it fits together in a way that the characters can, even if the characters are smart or insightful or whatever. But I think also there's that sort of more extensive backstory of Ramsay, the father, sort of, which forms part two of the book. And that, I think, was interesting to me because I just really don't like simple villains. I thought I needed the time to kind of get to the root of Ramsay and how he came to be. And especially because Melanie, who our protagonist, who's 17, the novel does have a little bit of a coming of age element to it. And so I thought it would be kind of only fair to give us a little bit more of the coming of age of the other main character.
But before we move into the 1991 stream of action, we learn about Ramsay's childhood, mm-hmm. and it's a very chaotic upbringing. His parents were always fighting, a lot of drinking going on at the house.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that was it. In a way, writing that middle section felt a little bit more like writing like a literary short story, the way that you kind of get at sort of how he, just that kind of father-son dynamic, which I'd written a lot about in sort of in shorter form, I wanted to kind of get at. And I think with the novels, but also with the short stories, I do a lot of thinking about causality, and it's always this war between wanting to show how A causes B without wanting to show that A exactly causes B. And so I wanted to just give enough of his sort of upbringing to give a sense of how he got to be who he is without exactly showing that, oh, because this single event happened to him, it caused him to do this other event 15 years later. I mean, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, but I always say, like, think about like so many movies begin with like, so there's a bully, schoolyard bully, and the schoolyard bully, she is taunting this other girl and pushing her down, and the girl's in the dirt, and the schoolyard bully says, you know, and this is why you're, you know, picked on, and this is why I'm in charge, and then it cuts ahead 20 years. And you'll see the kid who had been bullied, whose face was in the ground, is suddenly the meanest school principal in the world. So it's like, oh, that one event totally shaped her and made her realize that she could no longer be bullied and she was going to be the bully. And I always find that a little less realistic than the same exact scene, except for the bully is now the high school principal, who's still a bully. And it was like that earlier event sort of confirmed that, yep, she's the bully, and now she's going to be even better at it 20 years later. It's sort of like it is causality, but it's more like patterning, like it shows what she was like, and now later on this is sort of even more what she's like or something. So mm-hmm. I think that sort of like not direct causality is just very interesting to me. So I wanted to give enough of the childhood stuff with Ramsay just to give a sense of how he became who he is without exactly showing that this single event caused this other single event.
Now, back in 1991 timeline, Ramsay is a long-haul trucker, mm-hmm. and all that time alone is not doing him well at all.
Yeah, I was thinking he is a long-haul trucker, something about which I learned a lot in the past couple of years. And he doesn't like the radio. He doesn't sort of pass his time that way. He passes the time mainly thinking. For him, that's a really bad idea, because when you have a lot of time to think, sometimes the thoughts that you think are not very healthy ones.
But it's unusual because there is a book that we learn about that plays a part in his life coming up. But also back home, he has a cover band. Mm-hmm. And so he does a lot of time thinking, but he's very much led by these works of others, be it the book or the songs of other performers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a sort of a book of pseudoscience that he becomes hooked on and starts to believe. But again, it's a very short book and he reads it quickly, but then he can brood on it and think about it and knows just enough to not quite understand all of it. There was a book in the 70s called The Jupiter Effect that was written by two PhDs, and I don't know what their PhD in it was in. It was probably calligraphy, but basically teamed up and said, hey, we know that this crazy planetary event is going to happen where all the planets are going to line up and it's going to have this gravitational catastrophic effect on the Earth. And I think when I looked at that book, I don't know how I got a hold of it. I must have been around 14 and it just really scared me. It's like, wow, if scientists believe this, it must be true. And there are some kids in school who passed it around. And I just remember I had nightmares for years over it until the era that they were talking about passed. And lo and behold, the Earth was still there. And I think I held that with me for a long time and then started to think, well, what if you were an adult and believed all this? And what if your belief that the world was coming to an end didn't come to pass? What happens next?
I remember, you know, it's called planetary conjunction.
Yeah, super conjunction.
But there was a term called syzygy.
Syzygy, absolutely. Yeah. So all the planets line up. And it's sort of a good Scrabble word if you have the right letters. But yeah, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, all the planets lining up. Like, why would you need a word for that?
Well, it sounds like a good Hungarian word.
Yeah.
His wife, Allie, has become a pharmaceutical rep. Mm-hmm. And so she has kind of this career with a future to it. And he's kind of in a dead-end job. And so there's kind of some conflict between them because she's starting to expect more out of her life.
That's right. And they start to take on the trappings of middle class, which is something that Ramsey has never even imagined. So before they know it, she is this up-and-coming career person for a major corporation. And he, even though his job might not have unlimited potential, he is a trucker with a regular schedule and a regular paycheck, which is kind of more than he ever thought he would have. And so I think he blinks and all of a sudden he's married and has a child and lives in a decent neighborhood and is making more money than he would have thought he could have had. Among other things that freaks him out, I think one of the things that the novel is, it's kind of a family story. It's maybe an amped up one, but it's sort of a family story with the husband desperately worried that he's going to lose what he has.
This takes place in September of 1991, mm-hmm. and for most people, you probably don't remember that, but he mentions a song that he hears, not the song by name, but he mentions the name Nirvana, and as the cultural critics and the authors have told us, 1991 was the year that punk broke, and he has this classic rock cover band, mm-hmm. and so you can kind of see that there is a new paradigm coming in. Mm-hmm. That's with Nirvana, the alternative revolution, the punk revolution, whatever you want to call it. And so he's going to be lost in time because of this new wave coming his way.
Thank you, first of all, for saying that. I really appreciate you saying that. I mean, yes, exactly. I mean, he hears this particular Nirvana song for the first time on the radio, and he's a guy who, when he does occasionally listen to the radio, it's classic rock all the way, and yet this Nirvana song slips in, and his ears perk up in both an amazed way. I mean, he's really intrigued by this song and amazed by it and wants a classic rock cover band to play it, and yet it's sort of a quantum shift, and he can tell that culturally, even if he can't articulate it, there's a big change on the horizon, which sort of fits in with the rest of his life, this big change on the horizon.
Which happens to be the end of his family.
Which happens to be the end of the world.
Well, and I remember when I first heard Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Did you hear it on a classic rock station?
I did not. I was in college radio at the time.
Okay.
And I had gotten an advanced cassette at the beginning of August, mm-hmm. or the end of, it was the beginning of August. I put it in the car. I was driving back home. It's about a 10-mile drive. And my roommate and a buddy of mine were building a doghouse. Mm-hmm. And I said, guys, the new Nirvana's out. And oh my God, you have to hear this right now.
Yeah, and I had the same thing. Now, I first heard Smells Like Teen Spirit on K-Rock, New York classic rock station. And for some reason, they played it. That era, just like everything, the guitars were that much more distorted. The drums were that much harder. There was something that sounded different about it, even though it's mixed very simply and nicely, but it just has a different sound to it. But also, I remember the first time I didn't see it, but they were on Saturday Night Live, and the next day, everyone was like, did you see that? What was that? What was that drummer doing? He was flailing all over the place. Like, people were talking about it, that performance, in a way that they typically didn't talk about you know, bands on Saturday Night Live.
This is where I brag about myself. I was working for a top 40 station earlier that year, and the station was going through a lot of money problems, so we started signing off at midnight. Mm. And I would stick around after midnight and play songs that I liked on the air. I would get the official sign off, and I would start playing. Yeah. And I was a member of the Sub Pop Singles Club.
Oh, wow.
So I got the Sub Pop 45s each month, and one of them was Dive Back with Sliver by Nirvana. And that was probably December of 90 or January of 91 when that came out. And so I played Sliver, which is just an incredible song, on the air. So I was probably the first person to play Nirvana on a top 40 station in a small town in Arkansas.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
I got yelled at eventually, but I had too much fun. I played the Lemonheads and stuff that was going to be popular 3 years later. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I had a great music taste. I just happened to be ahead of the curve a little bit.
Yeah. But yeah, the music does function. You know, it's not a big part of the novel, but, you know, I was thinking, if this guy truly believes the world's going to end, what is he going to do? And the answer is his garage band's going to have their first and last gig, you know, and they're going to play. So the music kind of, he does think about what songs they would play and what, you know, what would they sound good doing.
But also it's pretty heartbreaking that a man in his mid-30s puts so much effort into his cover band.
Yep, it's true. I mean, who would ever do that?
It's nice to get around and play with friends and maybe even gig every once in a while, but to believe that it has so much meaning in your life, that's the tough part. Now, we talked about this kind of class conflict Ramsey's having, that he's achieved more than he ever aspired to, but there's still more, because he does live in a neighborhood with the local TV weatherman.
That's right. The local celebrity lives in town, you know, in his neighborhood, the TV weatherman, and it's basically a neighborhood of dentists and lawyers and doctors and stuff, and he just feels completely removed from all of that, even though realistically he's not, and his wife isn't, and she consequently, because she's home while he's driving, she's the one who meets the neighbors.
And she's the one taking care of Meg, as Melanie is known, as a child. Mm-hmm. And the resentment just grows and grows.
It does. And I think that's one of the things that she doesn't want to resent her husband, because, again, he's holding down this decent job. And it's not his fault that he's on the road a lot, because that's his job. On the other hand, there's some scenes in the book, and again, they're not major scenes, but little moments where it just becomes clear that she knows all of the details of her daughter in a way that Ramsey doesn't. Even things as simple as how to get the car seat on and how to lure her inside for brushing her teeth, and these little details that I think, as a parent, I realize that these little things that if you're away, you don't know. You don't know as well as the other spouse knows. And so Allie is starting to resent her husband more and more for really not quite knowing their daughter as well as maybe she'd like.
Well, and especially that age, development happens so quickly that it could be literally a different person every 2 weeks.
Yeah, and that's one thing that Ramsey begins to think, is how every time he comes home, it's not like his daughter's getting older, but it's like she's replaced by an entirely different child every time he comes home. And I gotta say, I completely stole that concept from a poet named Steve Gerke, who I don't remember the poem exactly, but it was a poem where he's talking about his daughter and going to visit her because he doesn't live with her all the time. And every time he shows up, it's like his daughter has been replaced by a new person. And I just thought that was pretty beautiful and totally true.
You get outside of New Jersey for this book. Yeah, West Virginia and some scenes out west as well. Mm-hmm. Do you think you're ever going to write a book set in your new home of Mississippi?
I've been in Mississippi now for 8 years, and I've written a total of three Mississippi stories, short stories. The first one was just awful. The second one was kind of gimmicky, so I don't even count it. And the third one I liked, except the main character was a Jersey transplant. So that was sort of the lens from which to tell the story. You know, I think when working on a novel, if it's going to take a number of years, it's a big investment. I don't know, I guess, is my answer to your question. I would like to. There's something about New Jersey, at least so far for the novels, that gives me a sense of comfort when working on it, because that location is so in my bones, both understanding of the geography, but also just understanding of the feeling of the geography, even though I really haven't lived there for 15 years. The thing that I'm starting to toy with now could potentially be set in Mississippi, for a bunch of practical reasons. So I don't want to say no, but I'm not sure where the next one's going to be set.
Your two novels have walked the fine line between literature and genre fiction with crime fiction. What kind of feedback do you get from other academic types about dabbling in the crime genre?
Quite honestly, it's been totally positive. I really, if there's a sense of like the snobby academic who, you know, wouldn't venture into genre territory. If that was true, it might have been true a few decades ago, or maybe more recently, but I just feel like I haven't encountered any of that. And if anything, I kind of know more and more people who are doing that in some way, if not crime, then horror, if not horror, then, you know, speculative fiction. But I do feel like those boundaries are, people care about them less, I think. I'm sure people in publishing care about them more because there's more sort of practical considerations. But I think in terms of like just the book or writing, or I don't read that kind of fiction, or I just haven't really encountered really any negative side to it.
I've seen a couple of essays in the past few years of people still talking down on genre fiction.
Yeah, I think though there's been more essays about the divide between like New York and MFA world than about sort of literary genre world. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. But I am saying that I really haven't encountered negativity about it.
What's the divide between New York and MFA world?
I think that, and again, I'm speaking in broad generalizations, but there's sometimes a sense that there is such a thing as like an MFA story, which is overly literary and not too attentive to plot, whereas New York is concerned more with, call it, good old-fashioned storytelling. But I think that those things are vastly overstated as well, and almost always written by people who did not actually go to MFA programs. I don't know anyone's MFA or grad school writing experience where they were told they have to write in a certain way. I mean, it's like if there was a day when everyone was writing a Raymond Carver story, that's just not remotely true, again, in my experience.
And did you see Birdman?
I'm dying to see Birdman. I am dying to see Birdman. It was in our theater for a very short time when our youngest son was too young to let us leave for more than an hour at a time. So I will be watching Birdman the second I can get it.
My favorite line of the book was, "He wasn't one who ordinarily quit things cold turkey, especially things he was good at, like drinking and asshole being."
Thank you. That was one of those sentences that came quickly, and I knew it was just fine. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I just like the concept of asshole being instead of being an asshole.
Yeah,
asshole
it seemed being. Like that was the right voice for his, you know, this is sort of a technical point, but one of the things I wanted to do this time was write a third-person novel. The 3-Day Affair was a first-person novel and functioning very much as a confession, and so his sort of voice was really important, and I wanted to do something different this time around. So I wanted to do a third-person novel, but still a third-person novel with a voice to it. And so because it's multiple perspectives, I could get into Ramsey's voice even in third-person. So thank you for that, because that is very much his voice.
Well, and shortly after, there was another line that I liked too. It's not quite as flashy, but he bought a napkin holder for the kitchen table and a kitchen table for the napkin holder.
Thank you.
Another thing that struck me personally was at one point Magruder's assistant says Melanie's accent is crazy thick, even though she has a crazy thick New York accent of her own.
Yeah, that just seemed like I've encountered those people before where, you know, you're somewhere in New York and I just picture her with this attitude, hearing someone walk in with a West Virginia, you know, or any accent, quite honestly, other than, you know, her immediate experience. And this idea that, you know, New York is supposedly a very worldly place, but really everywhere is just about as worldly as everywhere else, and people tend to stick in their small geographic region. And so it would make sense that she would hear an accent and be like, you know, crazy thick accent, even though she'd have this really heavy New York accent.
So you said you're playing around with another book idea right now. I mean, do you think it's going to go someplace?
I hope so. The way I think I've learned that I work is I get a few horses running and see which one I stay more excited about. I've got a few different things that I'm writing first, second chapters of, see which one I stay excited about after working on for a little bit. And they're pretty different from each other, too. I think after this novel, so the 3-Day Affair is about, it's a pretty short novel, it's about a 250-page first-person novel. And Before He Finds Her is about 100 pages longer than that with multiple points of view. And it seems to me like just sort of a bigger novel in all senses of the word. And so I thought I wanted to sort of pare it back down again. So that's one thing I was working on. But then I became excited about something else that might have four different perspectives. So I really don't. I don't know.
And you also just won a Pushcart Prize recently. Yeah. What was the story?
That was my Mississippi story with the New Jersey transplant.
So you got validation for it and you want to cast it away?
I know. It's sort of a high concept story, which is I was on hold once for the longest time with it was like a tech support thing. And I was just on hold longer and longer and longer. I think it was back when I had a Dell computer. It was just forever. And I started to think, you know, what if you had this company in the United States where they teach all the employees to speak with Indian accents. And essentially what that would do is if you were on hold, I think sometimes you're put on hold for a long time and you get someone with a heavy accent, you immediately think, oh, great, this isn't going to go that well. My problem's not going to get solved. And then if you get disconnected, you're like, well, of course I did. It's like, you know, halfway around the world. But what if all this was going on with a company that was, say, in Mississippi, and they trained their employees specifically to speak with perfect Indian accents, and basically their MO is to hang up on everybody, and therefore they don't have to actually fix anyone's computer. So it takes place at this company where they are, you know, the main character needs a job, and he gets this top secret job working, quote, tech support, which is really just to learn to speak with a perfect Indian accent and then hang up on all of his calls.
Michael Cardos is the author of Before He Finds Her, and it's available from the Mysterious Press. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.